550, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome into the 4 o'clock show. Brett Johnson with you on a very cold Tuesday afternoon. Getting those record low temperatures all around the country. Hopefully you don't have too many of your conservative friends telling you, where's the global warming now? Obviously not the case, since, as we've been over many, many times, a big difference between climate and weather. Before we get into our first interview for today, though, I do want to pass along some news in terms of what's happening at the state legislature, because, well, sad to report that Representative Hunter Cantrell, who represents the Burnsville and Savage area, today released a statement announcing that he will not seek re-election. Now, what's significant about Representative Hunter Cantrell is his age, as he was elected to the Minnesota House at only the age of 23. Unbelievable. What were you doing at 23? What was I doing at 23? Obviously not serving in the Minnesota House of Representatives. But Hunter Cantrell announced he will not be seeking re-election, as basically his reason was that he wants to go back to school to get his bachelor's degree, as he had to put that on hold when he ran for the House after he had a cancer diagnosis back in 2017. So, yeah, he's only 24 years old and, well, wants to go back to school to complete his degree, so certainly can't fault him for that. So happy to welcome in the founder of Student Loan Justice, Alan Cullinge, back to the program. Now, if you might remember from a few weeks ago, we had Alan on the program when he actually placed a Norzing Viking curse on the ECMC headquarters in Minneapolis. We only had about 10 minutes or so to visit during our conversation, so figured we better invite Alan back on the program to get more in-depth talk about student debt, because he is an expert on this topic, and glad to welcome Alan back on the program. So, Alan, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Brett.
Yeah, definitely. So, now that we have a little bit more time to chat about this topic, let's start off with the history of student loans, because the program, as I remember, was created back in 1965, and with largely good intentions, but obviously that has really changed over the years, hasn't it, the student loan system?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, if you go back and look at the signing statement of President Lyndon Baines Johnson back in 1965 when the Higher Education Act was created, he declares that the loans created through that legislation would be free of interest. And, you know, it's been, 40, 50 years now, and not only are the loans not free of interest, the federal government, it turns out, is booking something like $100 billion in interest on the federal portfolio every year. And unlike every other loan in this country, federal student loans have, since 1965, been uniquely stripped of nearly every fundamental consumer protection. So unlike every other loan in this country, student loans are vacated of bankruptcy protections, of statutes of limitations, collection practices, truth in lending laws. Even state usury laws are not applicable to federal student loans. And so this has really become a predatory lending system. And, you know, the colleges have benefited tremendously. The federal government is benefiting tremendously. But this is coming at just a massive social cost to the people.
So let's go through the history of this, because what caused the actual system to change? Was it a number of things over years, or was it maybe one bill that was passed through Congress at some point in history, or was it a slow burn? What actually kind of changed the system to move to, well, today's format, where basically, as you said, if you get stuck in student loan debt, you're pretty much there forever?
Right. Yeah, it was kind of a slow burn, quite frankly. So there was a company called Sallie Mae, which many of your listeners may be familiar with. It was created under President Nixon in 1973, actually. And so this was a quasi-governmental entity that was given essentially all the power to run the entire federal student loan system. But it was also a private company that could make a profit, it could pay shareholders, etc. The only difference was it had a couple of people from the Treasury Department on their board to sort of look over the shop. And so the government was essentially paying Sallie Mae to repurchase loans from banks. But as I said, because this company had a profit motive, it saw a great opportunity there to take away bankruptcy protections, nick away statutes of limitations, and So it started in the mid-70s. A bunch of stories were trotted out in the press about how students were, flocking from graduation straight bankruptcy court. And, oh, the sky is falling and the students are ripping us off and we can't have this. And so they put a restriction on bankruptcy discharge. So then, years came and went. What started out as a 5-year waiting period for bankruptcy discharge became a 7-year waiting period. And then ultimately in 1998, this was made essentially infinite. So, with no amount of time, student loans would be dischargeable in bankruptcy. And then in 2005, the student loan industry managed Congress to go even one step further and take bankruptcy rights away from private student loans, which had no government connection at all. And I might add, in 1992, they slipped in the removal of statutes of limitations. So it took them a while, but they certainly succeeded in stripping these loans of even constitutional bankruptcy protections. The founding fathers felt that bankruptcy rights were so important, they called for uniform bankruptcy laws in the Constitution, not the Bill of Rights, the Constitution itself. And they called for this ahead of the power to declare war, ahead of the power to raise an army and build a navy. And so the founders felt it was very important. But yet this has been uniquely taken away from student loans. And now we're seeing the results.
It's a little before my time, but I'm just trying to picture how this could actually, this legislation you're talking about over the years, could get passed without some sort of public opposition. And maybe as you were bringing up, it was more of a slow burn where people weren't necessarily paying attention, because that would strike me as being very problematic if I'm someone who's in college or just recently graduated from college and all of a sudden I see legislation that's going to take away my right to bankruptcy.
Yeah, well, it was a different time back then in the 70s. First of all, only a small fraction of students were borrowing student loans back then, maybe 15%, 20%. And the loans were very small. We're talking a few hundred dollars rather than tens of thousands of dollars, what we see today. And so the public attention on this issue just really wasn't there. However, there were people in Congress at that time that raised very serious objections. They said, hey guys, this is very concerning. This has constitutional violative implications. People are supposed to have equal protection. People are supposed to have, due process rights. And again, as I said, the constitutional bankruptcy rights that are demanded ahead of the power to declare war are also gone. So there was some pretty, some good people in Congress that were concerned and noted it. But apparently in that political climate back in the day, it just went right through. At that time, students were not flocking to bankruptcy court. It turned out, we know now with hindsight, that far less than 1%, in fact, about a third of 1% of student loans were being discharged in bankruptcy at that time. So this was a crisis only in the imagination. And, I think that the Congress from 1965 and forward, they would be shocked to see what has become of this lending system.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely the situation where you have a solution in search of a problem. We're speaking with the founder of Student Loan Justice, Alan Kolin. So, Alan, I want to move on to your background because you're an expert on this topic. And looking at your background and your bio on student loan justice, it looks like at one point you actually had your own small lending program that worked on behalf and contracted with the federal government. So that kind of gives you some firsthand knowledge on how the system works. And I'm sure that kind of led to you to wanting to found Student Loan Justice.
Yeah, that's right. For 3 years, I was the regional manager of a fairly small government-backed lending program for small and disadvantaged businesses in the Pacific Northwest. And, over those 3 years, I came to understand, as you point out, all my degrees are in engineering, I came to understand, fundamental banking principles, the theory of good faith and what that means. I became intimately familiar with. And when I stumbled upon this student loan problem, as a result of my own personal experience, it was obvious to me that something was just horribly awry. I mean, something had gone terribly wrong with the student loan system compared to the other government lending programs that I had been associated with. And so I started doing some research, and what I found was just shocking. You know, the money that the industry had plowed into Congress, on both sides of the aisle, by the way, but more so Republicans than Democrats, and, you know, the familial benefit that these congressmen, you know, they were getting their daughters and sons jobs in the industry at student loan collection companies, you know, $100,000 a year jobs for basically no work. And really just the amount of money that the lending industry was plowing into not just campaigns and political action committees, but also to a wide range of nonprofits that had close connections with members of Congress. So it was just disgusting to see. So I wound up taking my research to, first Bethany McLean, who's the reporter who broke the Enron story. And she wound up doing a 5-page feature in Fortune magazine. And then that very quickly crescendoed into an appearance on the top story of 60 Minutes in 2006. And it was really interesting for the 60 Minutes piece. Sally May, who then and now was the sort of the biggest for-profit company on the block, they refused to be interviewed. And even the Department of Education declined to be interviewed for this story. And so that was a pretty pretty telling fact there that really exposes a lot of the nonsense that's going on behind the scenes and how the power brokers in Washington really do not want to they run and hide when they're called to account for this fiasco.
And that was part one of our conversation with Alan Kolinge of Student Loan Justice as we're talking about, well, student debt, how to make improvements, and some of the problems with the collection process. We'll have part two of our conversation up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson on the 4 o'clock show on your Tuesday afternoon. Let's get back to our conversation now with Alan Kolinge of Student Loan Justice. Well, let's talk about one of these bad actors that's actually locally here to Minnesota, and that is ECMC, the Education Credit Management Corporation. They're technically a nonprofit, which is kind of unbelievable to me, being that they're, well, a debt collector, and they actually, well, do make some profits. So can you talk exactly about who is ECMC? Because as you kind of state, they're one of the biggest, if not the worst, debt collectors in the industry.
Yeah, ECMC is one of a nationwide network of sort of shadowy, they used to call them guarantors. And it was always unclear what these sort of middlemen, typically state agencies, but not always, all of them are nonprofit. It's very unclear what these so-called guarantors actually did. You know, for years and years, the federal government was the guarantor of the loans. So it turns out that what these quote-unquote guarantors do is they make 90% of their revenue collecting on defaulted loans. So when a student loan defaults in the absence of bankruptcy protections, absence of statutes of limitations, and in the presence of just a mafia-like collection regime, you know, they can turn a defaulted loan into 2, 3, 4, 5 times larger than, you know, what was originally borrowed. And these sort of shadowy guarantors, ECMC and others, they come in and, you know, the students are over a barrel. The students there's just no recourse for them because of what I just mentioned. And so these guarantors are just making a king's ransom of unearned wealth off the backs of the citizens. But with ECMC, it goes even further because over time, as the lending system has changed, ECMC has grown tremendously in strength to where today, you know, they're going around purchasing these teetering for-profit colleges who recruit at homeless shelters and, you know, make 90%+ of their wealth from directly from the taxpayers and provide just a horrible education where 80% or so of their students wind up in default. Keeps these teetering universities alive and probably buys them for pennies on the dollar. But, you know, these are the worst colleges in the country. You know, these are colleges that should have been shut down many years ago. And here we have ECMC making a king's ransom, not only on collecting on defaulted loans, but also on propping up these just terribly, terrible for-profit colleges. Why I focused on ECMC most, Brett, is the fact that ECMC holds a monopoly, essentially, for defeating student loan borrowers in bankruptcy court. So it's very hard to get student loans discharged in bankruptcy. There's these special conditions that must be met over and above all other loans. You know, in an average year of 149,000 people who file for bankruptcy with student loans, fewer than 20 even get partial discharges. And we have ECMC uniquely to thank for that, because they make their living, in addition to the other two ways I just mentioned, they will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat bankruptcy filers in court. This is what they do. And I think I mentioned in the last segment, one of our members had a $5,000 loan originally. He's a school teacher, and after 3 years of trying very hard to get his loans discharged in bankruptcy, he estimates the ECMC probably spent $200,000 or even $250,000 to defeat this borrower in bankruptcy court. So ECMC just checks all the boxes for being just the most ruthless, vicious, poster child for everything that is wrong with the student loan system. And so I thought it was very appropriate that we, being in Minneapolis, put this Viking Nidstang across from their corporate headquarters.
So as I'm sitting here listening to you and talking about how ECMC functions, how do you even become a company that even contracts with the U.S. government to collect loans like this? Is it largely a monopoly where there's barriers for entry and you can't even, get into the industry anymore, or is it?
Yeah, this is a very mature industry going back to the 70s. I don't know what the genesis of the guarantor, how the politics were going at that time. But I can tell you that most of the guarantors started out as sort of good old boy state legislator-driven entities where most of them were controlled directly by the state in which they were located. I don't know what ECMC's history is in particular, but it tended to be sort of a state-federal partnership. And boy, what a gravy train it was. You know, the guarantors like ECMC, they don't do any real work. All they do is essentially extract vast sums of unearned wealth from defaulted borrowers. So a $10,000 loan defaults, and pretty soon it's $40,000 or more with penalties and fees, collection costs, etc. And here comes ECMC or other guarantors to just really suck that money out of the borrowers. And, you know, because there are no statutes of limitations, no bankruptcy rights, they can follow these borrowers for the rest of their lives. And, people are literally committing suicide these days and fleeing the country. I mean, it's really become a nightmare out here. And, shame on companies like ECMC. They should have, particularly being nonprofits, you would think that they would have some sort of public benefit slant to them. But in fact, the opposite is true. You know, ECMC is really the poster child for everything that is wrong in the nonprofit industry. And
would anything even change really with them if they were to all of a sudden be classified as a for-profit corporation?
Well, quite frankly, no. They'd stop giving this pitifully small number of scholarships they give every year. I don't know
That's what they say. Oh, well, we do some good in the industry as well.
Yeah, right? We do some good. We give, a $500 scholarship here, $200 scholarship there, I'm guessing that maybe every year they give, I don't know, let's say $5 or $10 million in scholarships. I think it's probably less than that, actually, but compare that to the fact that they have $328 million sitting in an offshore bank account somewhere either in Central America or the Caribbean. I couldn't tell from their 990 filing. But you know, this company is not a good guy. And I might also add, one of their major subcontractors is a collection company that houses a 4,000-gallon shark tank in the lobby of their corporate headquarters, last I checked. And so, you know, something has gone horribly wrong with our nonprofit laws when companies like ECMC are allowed to do what they do and pay no taxes.
Well, that actually seems very fitting that this subcontractor would actually have a 4-gallon shark tank. That would kind of about sum up the way the company operates as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the ECMC is the worst of the worst. There is no company that I can point to pound for pound that is more vicious or ruthless than ECMC.
And if that wasn't enough for you, I want to touch on this angle as well, because we briefly brought this up during the last time we spoke, Alan, but that is the fact that they were caught in having some pretty shady investments in Central America and were even caught up in the Panama Papers scandal as well.
Yeah, that's right. As I mentioned, their tax filings show a very interesting $120 million investment. And well, I don't know that I can't say that the bank is in Panama for sure. We do know that it's either in the Caribbean or Central America. So whether it's whatever, it smells really bad. And you know, shame on them. Higher education was never meant to be, you know, a policing mechanism of the public. You know, I think Lyndon Johnson would be done to know to see what had become of this this lending program. You know, and not only is ECMC making just an incredible amount of money, but even the federal government, the Department of Education, is booking, well, as of 2012, they were booking about $50 billion a year in profit on the system. And today, I'm sure it's got to be far higher than that still, probably closer to $75 billion or so. We know that $100 billion is clicking off in interest alone on an annual basis. So this is not at all what the Congress had in mind in 1965.
So final question for you, Alan. This is kind of a loaded one, but what would the ideal student loan system look like in this country if you were able to wave a magic wand and change everything in terms of the way that students are able to borrow money to go to college?
Well, I mean, first of all, the bankruptcy protections that should have never been taken away have to be returned. Only then will the federal government restrain its lending, you know, maybe say, you know, we're no longer going to lend $120,000 to get a degree in underwater basket weaving. You know, it's only in the presence of bankruptcy protections that the prices will become rational. And quite frankly, Brett, I don't see why the government should be making any profit, why anybody should be making profit.
Yeah, it's the government.
On a lending system which is meant to educate our citizens. I mean, it just makes no sense. Mm-hmm. You know, the government doesn't make a profit in other areas. The Air Force doesn't make a profit. The, you know, Department of Agriculture doesn't make a profit, et cetera. So why should the federal government be seeing these student loans as an income source rather than an investment? I just don't get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've been speaking with Alan Collins. He is the founder of Student Loan Justice, and we'll definitely be checking in with you periodically, Alan, to figure out what's been going on in this industry, and really appreciate you joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you, Brett. I've enjoyed it.
And coming up next, we're going to switch gears and get the latest news in the labor movement, as we'll be speaking with Filiberto Nolasco Gomez of Workday Minnesota, as we'll be talking about last week's elections and the impacts on labor. And then we'll also talk about a strike that is currently happening in Blaine. But first, let's get to our newscast from Public News Service. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Well, it's that time now where we're going to check in on what's happening with the labor news here in the state and also at the national level. As we're very happy to welcome back to the program, Filiberto Nolasco Gomez. He is the editor of Workday Minnesota. Hey, Filiberto, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, happy to be on again.
Yeah, so before we get into some strikes that have been happening in Minnesota, I want to go back to something that happened last week, and that, of course, was the election last Tuesday, because We actually had some good news on election night regarding union-backed candidates and initiatives doing well in local elections here in Minnesota. Can you highlight a few of those?
Yeah, it was a very exciting time for folks that are sort of watching the elections. Union-backed candidates won a lot of races out in the suburbs, city, school of education, board of education candidates, and also importantly, women and people of color won a lot of elections. So, for example, in Duluth, the city's first African-American council member was elected. In St. Louis Park, first Muslim and Somali city council member was elected. So just a lot of good things happening all over the place. I think a really interesting story comes out of Worthington as well, where a school levy was passed. And that levy was particularly contentious because of perceptions in the past of the levy losing because there was no interest among the mostly white community in Worthington to support schools that would go to youth of color, since there's so many minorities in Worthington, which often surprises people because it's 3 hours south of Minneapolis.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and they've had, of course, with their plant down there, it's a place that's picked up a lot of immigrants and really changed that community, so certainly some good news there to see that that referendum actually ended up passing in Worthington, being that, well, the town has gotten some negative press over the past few weeks and months, especially here in town in Minnesota, regarding, well, some less than, nice people that are in Worthington, but glad to see that there are still some good people down there helping to get that passed.
You know, and I did my own reporting down there a couple of months ago, and what I found was a lot of conscientious and thoughtful people just sort of dealing with the complexity of a mostly white community suddenly becoming dominated by folks of color. And it's certainly a challenging situation, but it's one that has a lot of folks that are invested in it to move that conversation forward. And I think it's important that we keep watching and are attentive to what it means for immigrants to be in rural communities all over Minnesota, because it is the case that there are a lot of immigrants all over rural communities in Minnesota.
So as you talk to folks down in Worthington, and this can be for both Worthington and also throughout Minnesota as well, what made some of these campaigns successful?
Yeah, in the weeks leading up to the election, what we saw was a lot of folks from the Twin Cities, a lot of organizing, and organizing that's been developed over the last 2 years with UFCW 663, with different immigrant rights advocacy organizations that were supporting a church. And there's a particular church that's been a sanctuary church for some time. Father Callahan has been organizing there for 8 years now. And so really it's been a couple of folks seeding the organizing that's led to this victory, and then also being supplemented by Twin Cities folks going down and supporting their efforts.
So at the national level, of course, we talked about here in Minnesota, we certainly have some good news that happened last week with the election. How about nationally? I know you don't necessarily focus on that at Workday Minnesota, but I'm sure you were following along with what was happening on the national level with some of the elections. What sorts of news did we see there with labor?
I mean, I think what we're seeing really is labor staying really close to historically marginalized communities. So that's people of color, women, trans folks, queer folks, et cetera. And you're seeing a big victory in places like Virginia, where the legislature is now Democrat, and to go along with the Democratic governor. In Kentucky, there's a Democratic governor now. I mean, there's a lot of move and a lot of effort. And it's certainly exciting generally to see that people are much more responsive to organized labor and the message that's coming out of organized labor. But I think that also represents a shift in the leadership to one that is less insular and more willing to engage people directly and seed leadership. I mean, you have in even South Dakota, there's a candidate for the AFL-CIO, young guy, Cooper Carraway, that I've profiled before. And, you know, he's very young, he's very determined, and he has a clear vision of how to move labor forward to meet the needs that people have. And it's just exciting to see those developments happen over time and over the country.
So let's move on to some, unfortunately, not so good news, and that is what's happening up in Blaine with a strike by United Steelworkers, their local 63B chapter, as about 220 members are on strike due to unfair labor practices at the Carly Foundry plant over in Blaine, which supplies parts to aerospace and other firms. Can you tell us a little more detail about this strike and what it's over, again, with the United Steelworkers, local 63B up in Blaine?
Yeah, so it's about 220 workers. It started not this last Saturday, but the one before. And it's a foundry that's been around, that's been owned by the same family for about three generations. And it seems like this current generation that's been running the factory has been a lot more hands-off And at the bargaining table, they're asking these 220 workers to take a lot of concessions. And in response to those demands for concessions in the contract bargaining, these workers went on strike.
So as I was reading through this, it sounds like a lot of the ideas that they weren't happy with being proposed by management was that they were proposing what looked like a lower wage tier for new employees and other economic and contract language changes that has instead united a lot of these workers in solidarity. So certainly some good news there.
Yeah, and it certainly reflects a national push. What we've seen in the last couple of years is, especially during the economic crisis, increasingly companies would ask for wages, different wages for new and incoming workers, and you saw that in the auto manufacturing negotiations. And it's really, really important that at this stage, years now from the economic crisis, when companies are getting record profit, that workers are pushing back against that tiered system and saying, no, every worker needs to make the same, and we're going to push back against that. It's been a big move. It requires a lot of, I think, courage from workers to say, no, we're not going to allow status quo to happen, and we're going to fight that off.
So you went to Blaine this past weekend talking to some of the workers and getting a look at the strike and the protests that were happening. What did you hear from some of the workers and the other folks that were there?
Yeah, it was a really tough protest. I mean, it was getting into negative temperatures. So it's really hard. It's being a journalist in Minnesota is really hard because of how cold it is and how much it affects the gear. But what we're seeing from workers is just a lot of determination. And the particular action that I was at had a lot of representatives from a lot of different unions all over the state. And so there was also a lot of solidarity and a lot of interest and support to make sure that these workers get a good contract. I think, the workers that are there at the foundry have been there for a long time. They're really committed to their work. And that's certainly expressed in a lot of what they were telling me. And so, you know, the story is always the same. Folks aren't looking to become millionaires. They're just looking for a decent wage and feel respect. And part of feeling respect is to have decent wages and benefits and just be treated well in the workplace.
Have we received any comment yet from management itself in response to the strikes?
Yeah, I've reached out to them, and they still have yet to comment, so I don't know what's going on there. It's always a little strange when management doesn't, say anything.
All right, so again, they're still on strike right now. Are we expecting any movement in the coming days or weeks, or what's the latest you can tell us?
As far as I know, there should be another negotiating session this week, and so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, we'll have to stay updated indeed as well. As again, that's with the United Steelworkers Local 63B. They work at the Carly Foundry plant up in Blaine and currently on strike. We've been speaking with Filiberto Nolasco Gomez. He is the editor of Workday Minnesota, doing lots of great work over there reporting on a lot of the local news that has to do with labor here in Minnesota. Filiberto, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We're live for the rest of the hour now, as we'll have one more segment where we'll take your calls at 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Is up next, I want to talk about whether we should have a secret ballot in the Senate for the inevitable impeachment trial of Donald Trump. We'll get to that up next here on the program. And we're back for the final segment of the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. It's Brett and Eric with you on a Tuesday afternoon. This is the one segment of the show where we'll take your phone calls over at 952-946-6205 to chime in on any of the topics that we talked about during the interviews or anything else, pretty much. We'll kind of make it a free-form last segment of the show. I have a couple pieces of news to pass along to you. Don't forget, there is still one more election that is actually going to take place this month, and this one could have significant impacts at the national level. Here's how. So, Louisiana is actually holding a runoff election for their governorship coming up this Saturday, of all things. Haven't heard of too many Saturday elections, but here's why it's significant. As you can imagine, Louisiana being in the South, they have both houses of the state legislature controlled by Republicans. But their current governor is a Democrat by the name of John Bell Edwards, and he is running for re-election against a Republican challenger by the name of Eddie Rizzponi. And right now, the polls show it's a very tight race, with Edwards leading in the latest poll by a 50-48 margin. And this could have big impacts in terms of the U.S. House, because if Republicans are to win that governorship, that means after the 2020 elections, Louisiana could conceivably become a state that would be Republican gerrymandered, where if John Bell Edwards, the current Democratic governor, wins re-election, that would, of course, block a possible Republican gerrymander. And even though it doesn't sound like a whole lot, that could be the difference between having Democrats or Republicans gain an extra 1, 2, or maybe even 3 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So do watch that coming up on Saturday. Ooh, and it was over before it began. We have a Republican who has dropped out of the presidential race. No, it's not Donald Trump. Mark Sanford, the infamous South Carolina governor, has announced that he is going to be ending his presidential campaign. Sanford said there was no appetite on the right for a nuanced conversation on the fiscal deficit. And if you don't quite remember Mark Sanford, a quick refresher course, he was the guy who, in the middle part of this decade, was the guy who basically went to South America to meet up with his mistress, even though he told all of his campaign aides and the general public that he was hiking on the Appalachian Trail. It was kind of a funny story in the middle part of the decade. Yeah,
damn, I love that guy, because he just left his responsibilities. Yeah. And it's like, you have kind of an important job.
Yeah, and literally everyone at that time was wondering, where is the governor? That's kind of a freaky person to lose track of. Where's the governor? Oh, yeah, he's just hiking the Appalachian Trail. Oh, no, he's actually seeing his... Was it Brazil or Argentina? It was one of those South American countries.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it was Argentina.
Yeah, I think you're right, too.
I thought it was Buenos Aires he went to.
That would make sense. Yeah, he'd probably go to Argentina. Yeah, see his mistress. Either way, he is out of the presidential race. He probably still has better morals than the current guy in the White House.
Well, he's an honest-to-God deficit guy, which I feel like most of those guys are just full of it.
Yeah, well, I wonder when he flew to Buenos Aires if he was using taxpayer funds, because that would kind of blow up that whole fiscal deficit argument in his face. Let's go to the phone lines and talk to Mark in Fridley, who wants to chime in about student loans. Hey there, Mark.
You bet. Well, I want to talk about that, and then I want to talk about Armistice Day. But you talked about how could they possibly draft legislation that would tie people into long-term malignant terminal debt slavery, which is what they did and what they've done. It's because they can make a buck at it. And this was planned. This was intentional. That, and combined with the outsourcing of jobs of the American middle class, put these people into positions where they will not be able to get a leg up on each other. And when you look at this legislation, it's like when I said they passed, Nancy Pelosi shoved the Lower Drug Cost Now Act of 219. Which 2019, which is H.R. 3. And there was a progressive alternative that actually did what the bill said it would. Nancy Pelosi's bill does what it says it's going to do, but it'll be in 100 years. In 2003, they passed something called the Medicare Modernization Act. And any time you hear the word modernization, or they're going to have to repass the Freedom Act again, and we need to talk about that. But anytime in 2004, there was the American Job Creation Act. It was 980 articles and amendments, and it didn't have a single word about the creation or the preservation of a single American job, and it was all about outsourcing jobs and tax breaks for outsourcing jobs. But hey, the name was the American Job Creation Act, so I could go back to my constituents and say, hey, everybody, I voted for the American Job Creation Act. This Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 prevents us to this day from negotiating price for drugs and we have to pay full pop, full retail for everything.
All right. So, thanks so much for the call there, Mark. Do appreciate it as we are approaching the end of the show. I think at some point, if we ever bring back the Solution Show here on the Repartee, we should no longer allow elected officials to name bills. Because as Mark brings up, how often do we see bills that have nothing to actually do with their name? I think the best example is obviously the Patriot Act. Still can't believe we had
or the Citizens United.
You're right. That still kind of fits. I was going to say it's not a direct piece of legislation. It was the name of the group, but you still shouldn't be able to really name your organization if it has nothing to do with actually what you're promoting.
Kind of the opposite of what you're actually doing.
Yeah, exactly. I think we need to kind of make it like what they used to do with newspapers, where they would actually have separate people actually write the headlines from those who actually wrote the articles or wrote the opinion pieces, because I don't know if that's still the case actually in newspapers, but I know at some point they actually had separate people who were actually dedicated to writing the headlines and the sub-headlines. I'm sure that's probably changed, though, in the years of consolidation and corporate ownership of newspapers, but I think that would certainly be a good policy to actually not allow politicians to name their bills anymore. Just have some nonpartisan, independent person in there that would actually go ahead and name the bills to what they actually end up doing in the long run. 952-946-6205. I have time for just a couple more phone calls before we wrap up our program today. And let's finish things up with we'll hold off. I don't think we quite have time for a phone call. So I do want to wrap up with this, though, since Politico, Juliana Glover, just recently wrote a piece talking about how conceivably, if they wanted to, Republicans could actually conduct a secret ballot when it comes to their impeachment vote when, of course, the impeachment trial will inevitably move to the Senate. Because even though this Supreme Court head justice, John Roberts, will preside over the proceedings, it's still the Senate that still gets to set up the basic rules, which means if you were to get three Republican senators that were to say, hey, I want a secret ballot, they actually could do that. There's just one problem, though, with this. I would think with how partisan the Senate is, you could generally figure out who is voting for impeachment and who is voting against it. You would probably know at about 85 of the 90 senators, and from there you could probably do the math on the other 10 to 15. So I say let them have a secret ballot, because in the long run, probably won't do them any good. That's all the time we have today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Food nourishes us. We need food to live. But how are we nourishing the food system? Well, actually, we're throwing a bunch of chemicals and we're making the dirt.